In summer 1941 comes one of the most dramatic shifts of the war, as the Germans turn east to attack the Soviet Union, and the pressure suddenly comes off the British home front. This indicates a new phase of the war, one that was in some ways already ongoing, and what I'd like us to call the Soviet Imperial and Expert War, which lasts until the spring of 1943. It's hard to overstate the significance of the German turn away from the West in terms of shaping Britain's experience of the Second World War. Although air raids continue, including some deliberately shocking attacks on medieval cathedral cities in response to British bombing of German cities, the sustained aerial campaign against Britain ceases in May 1941. In 1942 and 1943, more people are killed in road accidents in the UK than are killed by German bombing. Germany could not ever have bombed Britain out of the war. It simply didn't have a large enough air force to do that, but it could have killed a lot more people. And the reason that Britain escaped so lightly during this third phase of the war is principally because the Russians are dying in such numbers instead. In fact, in absolute terms, British servicemen are also escaping very lightly, because the bulk of the army, the largest armed service, is training at home with the intention that it won't be committed to battle until a combination of British bombing and Russian resistance on the Eastern Front has broken the German army. The major commitment of British forces outside the UK is in Egypt and Libya, where they've been struggling with the Italians since summer 1940. But even here, a good deal of the fighting is actually being done by soldiers from India and the Dominions. This imperial aspect of the war is even more evident in the end of 1941, when Japan enters the war on the side of the Axis. This also leads to America being brought into the conflict on the Allied side, a somewhat mixed blessing for Britain, which will now have to struggle for US-produced supplies in competition with the American armed forces, and is not released from the bonds of financial dependence forged when America was neutral in 1940. In Southeast Asia, the Japanese advance kills or takes prisoner large numbers of British Empire troops, the overwhelming majority of them Indian, during the conquest of the colonies of Burma and Malaya in the early months of 1942. This in turn will result, the capture of those colonies will result, in further resource deprivation on the home front, since they're major sources of oil and rubber. Amongst British personnel, however, the burden of the war is borne most heavily in this period by two groups: the merchant seamen, who were struggling to bring supplies into the country in the face of an escalating German submarine campaign, and the aircraft crews, who were trying to bomb Germany into submission. These are very small, highly trained sets of men, and they suffer extremely heavy losses relative to their number. But in terms of absolute casualties, it's a very Britain escapes very lightly in this period. For the British home front, much of the military pressure comes off during this period relative to its predecessor. At the same time, however, the level of state control continues to increase. Whereas Britain's strategists had originally aimed to fight a three-year war, in which the military power to overcome Germany would have been created by the end of 1941 and victory achieved in 1942, the fall of France, the expansion globally of the conflict, and the series of disasters experienced by Britain's armed forces at the start of 1942 all make it apparent that mobilisation will have to be continued and extended in order to fight a longer war. Resources continued to be ploughed towards the military in huge quantities. The autumn of 1941 sees the decision to commit even more fully to the creation of an enormous bomber force to attack Germany, and the looming shortage of manpower results in extensions to conscription. And I think the amount of effort that goes into this bombing campaign is really underappreciated. You know, by 1943, I think construction crews working for the RAF had laid enough tarmac and concrete in bomber runways to pave over the whole of Birmingham. It's really it's a colossal effort. One in 10 people in the British workforce is working for the Ministry of Aircraft Production by 1943. It's a huge proportion of the workforce. Now, in sharp contrast to the unemployment of the interwar period, not only is everyone in Britain who wants a job employed, but the state's actively pursuing many of those who are not in paid work in an effort to persuade them to join the labour force. At the same time, although the anti-inflationary measures introduced in 1941 have been highly successful in preventing any major increase in prices, working class wages in a time of labour shortage continue to rise, overtaking and exceeding the increase in the cost of living. By 1945, the cost of living had increased by about 30%, but weekly wages had gone up by 50%. Earnings go up even more because longer hours are being worked. And in fact, household incomes are increasing even more than that because more people within each household are employed. In contrast, most middle-class salaries remain almost static throughout the war. Apart from factory managers, they're really the only people who are earning more. Now, simultaneously, rationing ensures that despite differences in income, everybody gets access to a broadly similar basic supply of goods. Although, in practice, both in intention and in practice, this is very far from a wholly equal system. Certain categories of people, servicemen, miners, expectant mothers, children, get more food. And those with more ready cash who are willing to use the black market are also able to consume rather more than their fair share. Nevertheless, one of the things that you see in this period is a levelling of consumption between the classes. And whereas the period 1939 to 41 had been one of relatively poor public health and increasing rates of infant mortality, the period from 1941 to the end of the conflict sees general improvements in health and declining infant mortality. And I think actually the rise in working class incomes combined with rationing is probably the key determinant of that. It's not just an awareness of the inequalities of the 1930s, but an anxiety about what will happen when this relatively happy situation of full employment and rising real incomes comes to an end when hostilities finish, that sees the Beveridge Report into social insurance given such a positive reception when it's published at the end of 1942. Whilst the obvious failure of the pre-war policy of appeasement following the fall of France in 1940 did much to wreck the political chances of the Conservatives in a subsequent election, it's the Labour Party's an ambiguously positive response to Beveridge and its commitment to ensuring greater social security in what's expected to be an unstable period after the end of hostilities, that guarantees that Labour will reap the benefits of the Tory collapse, albeit this was not a political outcome that was obvious to many at the time.